Hello, and welcome to the Shifting Lens, where we are viewing the animal experience. Today, we're talking about non-traditional companion animals. I'm joined by Tiamat and Molly, along with Molly's companion parrot, Bifrost, and my royal python, Pep. You'll definitely hear from Bifrost occasionally, but if you're listening to audio only, feel free to visit our YouTube channel and see them both and Bifrost's wonderful hairstyling ability.
Yep.
So, we want to talk a little bit about why we have non-traditional pets and why we consider them non-traditional, but also a little bit about our relationship with them, because I know typically people think of companion animals or pets as dogs and cats. And so, to have a parrot and a snake in the room is definitely an interesting conversation. So, if Molly wants to start, let's talk about why Bifrost joined your household.
That's a really great question. I worked with birds on and off after college. I just picked up a pet industry retail job in college and loved working with animals and ended up at a specifically a bird store and got to spend a lot of time with birds. And I think this was when I got really interested in animal behavior. So I started really trying to understand the parrots and I loved handling them and I loved helping them with grooming, ironically. And I just really enjoyed them. And I did end up sharing my life with a few parrots before Bifrost, and just various situations. They ended up not staying in my life. But I missed having birds. And my husband understood that and said, well, hey, this cute little conure, who is right now, for those of you just listening, is really going to town on my hair right now. Yeah, he's just super fun, super sweet, super cute, smart. Everyone probably curious if he's a speaking parrot. He does not mimic. He'll mimic a couple of motions and he says the word but he's not specifically a quote unquote talking parrot. But he's also guest starred in a few of these recordings before, just walking in the background.
I guess
Yeah.
is all you really need to know, right? But I think that's the one thing. If you can say you can get along in most languages, I think. You're like,
That's true. True. That is the universal social connector, isn't it? So yeah. But no, he's a fun companion. He's definitely not snuggly. For those who are curious, we don't like crawl into bed and snuggle or anything like that. He just wants to hang out. And I enjoy going to faculty meetings like this with him just chilling on my shoulder or my head. Just gives him a chance to be involved and entertained. And we hang out. He sits with me when I'm reading. He sits with me when I'm writing. He's very much a part of my life usually for, anywhere from 8 to 10 hours a day. We're usually hanging out. So that's life with this little parrot. Hey, buddy.
I think it's nice too that he's not always in the cage necessarily, that it's, or whatever you want to call it, a cage or whatever. But
No, yeah, he has a cage. It's yeah, I wouldn't, I don't have to go so far as being like his enclosure. But having said that, I have a big giant climbing tree for him that's out of the shot, that's right over here that he gets to play on. In fact, I also sometimes involve him with my student projects. So he's gone to campus, he has a travel backpack. And so he'll go to campus, he'll do different target training exercises with the students, stuff like that. So he actually has a very enriched, very active life for a little bird.
I don't want to ask this because I know I'm gonna laugh. But does he wear the backpack?
No, he does not wear the backpack. That's a good question. He has a backpack he rides in with a perch, and it's this nice, pretty cloth and plastic enclosure for him to safely ride in. But
That's what I thought it was. I
yes.
thought it was gonna be one of those things where they have like the little thing and they can look out of it. But I
Yes.
was just imagining him wearing a backpack on your head, and it was too much. I just
It
couldn't
is.
handle
That
it.
would be the most adorable thing ever. I think he would complain, and therefore, I don't think I can put him through that. But that
And
mental image is amazing.
especially for the listeners, probably won't know this anyway, but Molly has a therapy chicken who wears a tutu sometimes. So my
True.
question, if you put it in context, wasn't too crazy to ask if the parrot wears a backpack.
It's
So in my
completely fair.
mind,
It
in
is
my mind.
completely fair. Yes. That sounds like something I would do if he wouldn't get very upset and probably bite the snot out of me. So and be fair. Totally be fair. The chicken doesn't do that, but we have boundaries in this relationship, right, bud?
Yes, clear boundaries.
Yes. As he pulls and does my hair. I mean, like we were saying before we popped on, this is like pandemic hairstyling 101. You know, multiple people let their spouses do their hair. I let my parrot do my hair. And then I wonder next morning why my cowlick looks like that. But Rebecca, you have your friend with you who looks mm-hmm. way more snuggly than mine. Who's that?
So this is a pep. He's a royal python or a ball python, which means when he's threatened, he curls up into a ball and sticks his head right in the middle. So of all of the possible snake breeds to have as a pet, he's definitely a non-threatening one. He's almost full grown, about 3 feet long, and he's quite chunky, maybe an inch and a half in diameter. But so he's interesting because I know a hobbyist breeder who was unable to sell him due to a neurological issue he has. His morph, which if you look, morph is his pattern. Mm-hmm. The pattern's called spider, and spiders tend to come with an issue where they have trouble holding their head still. Their head wobbles a lot, and throughout their life, it gets weaker and weaker. So he has some challenges, like he's not very good at catching his prey, if you will. So I feed him frozen thawed rats and I kind of wiggle it a little bit with the tweezers. So he thinks it's alive and he gets into hunt mode and he pounces on it. Pounce isn't correct. Strikes at it. He strikes at it, but he often misses. And aww. So... he definitely needs someone to make sure the rats can't hurt him. But yeah, he does not like nearly as much enrichment as Bifrost. They're very solitary. They're very quiet. They just like having their dark, warm place to go to. So when he's out with me, he often explores quite a bit and then eventually settles down. So if you're watching, you can see he's settled up against my neck now and he'll occasionally push his nose into it trying to burrow. But yeah, so when I'm researching or writing papers, he tends to sit with me like this and just soak up the warmth. But for the most part, I leave him alone. He has his little enclosure, which is a substrate that he can burrow into, his hide that's on top of it. And he actually has some vines in there because even though he's a desert snake, he loves climbing, which is odd for his particular species, but he actually does love climbing up to the top of the enclosure on a vine and usually weighing it down. So I have to prop it back up for him. Yeah.
That's so cute. So I don't live with any non-traditional companion animals, so to speak. And I grew up with all sorts of animals and chickens and dogs and horses, but I never thought of living with a non-traditional companion animal. So what was your guys' motivation to say like, oh, I'm gonna get a snake or a bird or something like that? Because I know Molly has a few different critters.
It's true. I've had non-traditional critters my whole life. From when I was younger, I had lizards, I had leopard geckos, I had snakes, I had monitor lizards, I had all sorts of stuff growing up as a kid. I don't know why, I think just all animals were cool and my family didn't draw any specific boundaries. They were like, hey, if you can research it and take care of it, then go for it. But they were always my responsibility and I had to do the work. I mean, I was that bad kid that had an iguana, like, you know, had the animals that probably weren't the most appropriate at that age, or to have necessarily in just an enclosure or something like that. I mean, there's a lot that goes into selecting these companions and the hype and the culture and the industry and all of that. But yeah, I had them for most of my life. I stopped for about 5 years, just in time to meet my husband before I, you know, showed him this side of my life.
you released it.
Yes, and then slowly reintegrated these species back into my life, I think when we were in a place where he was ready for them. Yeah, I share my home both with Bifrost and with two white-lipped pythons, and with a small enclosure filled with cockroaches, of all things. Cockroaches usually live with me on campus, but they're back, they're home for the winter right now. And the snakes are they're young and they're very nocturnal, so I'm not gonna harass them right now. But yeah, they just, it's sort of always been part of my life in some way, shape or form. I can hear my puppy howling in the background. I apologize, this is coming through for everybody. But Yeah, I mean, it maybe goes into also my interest of also more ancient dogs. I don't know. I guess there's just something that draws me to animals that are very, I guess the words probably in my head are authentic. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of non-traditional animals, I mean, we have color mutations. Actually, Bifrost is a color mutation. So Bifrost is called a yellow morph green cheek conure. So he has the yellow belly and the red on him as well, and some of the extra blue and things like that. So we both have color morph animals. But for the most part, they're not that different from how they would be in a non-companion animal setting. So maybe there's a draw there. I don't know. I think it's a great question. It's something I have not dug around and focused nearly hard enough on. Self-growth needs to happen here.
So for me, I've always been fascinated by various animals, and especially with snakes, because so many people find them gross or scary, I almost felt more inclined to shout at everyone that they're really not. They're wonderful. Mm. They're soft. They're friendly. He's trying to get to the camera now. Yeah. So I had Budgie when I was younger. It was my mom's choice. She loves birds. But I never had reptiles growing up because they freaked my mom out too. And she's actually had some exposure therapy with a pup, and she's doing well. She can hold him. But so it wasn't until I knew someone who was breeding and trying to get various color morphs that are worth more money and actually going through that process that I considered getting one. But hearing more and more about the trade and about the process of, you know, valuing them based on their appearance and whether they're proven breeders and stuff like that, it kind of started to really bother me. So I had resolved myself not to participate. But when this little guy came along all broken and worthless per the breeder, he is worth something to me. So yeah. It's my little friend. But I don't think I would get another one. Every time I go into the reptile store to get him his feeder rats, I do say hello to every interesting creature in there. And I'm a huge, huge fan of hognose snakes. And the Savannah monitor in there is like 6 feet long. She's beautiful. But I can't bring myself to add to the collection here because I feel kind of bad about not being able to really know where they came from. Like, at least this breeder, I know all those snakes are taken care of, all of them are socialized, they get time out, they get time spent with their people, and I know that they're not overbreeding anybody and stuff like that, but I feel like I couldn't know that in every situation, which I guess brings us to some of the issues with
right
non-traditional pets. Like Molly, you were saying earlier that you don't like the term exotic.
Yeah, I don't. It's not a word that really fits a lot of the animals. Exotic, yes, can be, you know, non or non-local, as it were, mm-hmm. but there are plenty of local species that are exotic because they're not normal pets. And also it will associate things like exotics with things like Tiger King, with owning wolves and tigers and bears and all sorts of more challenging or dangerous animals to share somebody's home or enclosure with. But it's important to remember that things like hamsters are exotic pets. The word exotic in different people's minds creates different associations. And a lot of those associations can harm the animals that they are labeled. Even, you know, some dogs, you know, are can fall into that category. And that can play into legal issues, laws. I mean, I had to have a permit for him when I lived in New Jersey, but now I live in Montana. Montana doesn't care because Montana's concern is whether or not they will be an invasive species. Well, parrots can't survive in a Montana winter. So they're not worried about it. I don't need paperwork for him now. Same with my reptiles. But yeah, if I lived in a different state where Florida, you need a lot of paperwork because if they get loose, they are detrimental to the environment. Mm. Or if they're very large, maybe they're dangerous to people. But that's the hard part, is I don't blame organizations like the USDA and stuff for not, they can't know the ins and outs of every relationship with every species or every individual of every species. I think it's very complicated. And I think when we just stick the boom label of exotic animal on there, a lot of us are just those kooky weirdos with tigers in their backyards, right? And I think that's pretty far from the truth. I mean, one of the fun things, I mean, I love watching you handling APEP right now, Rebecca, in having my snakes and a friend of mine who's a cat trainer she has snakes as well. We've been discussing reptile training, and that's actually like a growing contingent of like the training community is legit like really? Snake training.
Yes. Interesting.
Yes.
I've seen some with fish, but not with reptile. Fish I've seen, but the reptiles haven't come up as much for me.
Yeah, well, it's just, we're not that we're getting bored with dogs and cats, but we're sort of like, well, where can we go with this? We work with birds, we work with dogs, we work with cats, we work with horses. But there's a growing interest on how close can we get with reptiles? How much, you know, their brains are different. And, but can they still get that cognitive associative learning that we can do with mammals and you know, other warm-blooded critters? So, yeah, super fascinating stuff. And it's just interesting the dimensions we take for granted, I think, well, with a lot of these species.
And I think a step before training or educating other animals is that the relationship, of course, and before we started recording this podcast today, Rebecca, you were speaking a bit about the bond with a pep and recognition of you as an individual, mm-hmm. and not just an obstacle that he's climbing on, but, you know, that. So I don't know if you wanted to share what you were sort of telling us before, because I thought that was so interesting as someone who hasn't lived with a reptile before.
Yeah. I lived with my partner when we got him, but there's a big difference in how he responds to myself and my partner. And I think it's because I entered the situation cautiously respectful, but my partner entered it fearful. And I think they can really tell, as much as any like dog or cat would respond to our emotions. Right. And so I think that has led him to be more comfortable with me too. I mean, I was talking earlier and I was pointing out something on him and he wiggled over and booped my finger. And I think he he's funny about that. He'll occasionally come towards my face and he'll bop my nose and then go on with his day. And I don't quite know what he's thinking, but I know that he's not the same way he is with me, with other people. So he's a little confused now, I think, because I'm talking and I don't normally talk this much when I have him with me. So he's looking around for what's going on, just more more stimuli than he's used to. But yeah, I think, I mean, I remember reading some papers and some, I guess, opinion pieces about the relationship with certain reptiles and how it is more a collector's item. It is more about, you know, getting all of the morphs that you want and having a nice thing to look at, and how decorating their enclosures is more for the human experience than for the animal. And I will say his enclosure's ugly, but he's happy, right?
Like right.
He seems to enjoy it. I mean, I guess I can't say he's happy, but he moves around it and he returns to his little home. And yeah, I think there's definitely a relationship there.
And I guess more recently with Tiger King, there was the whole scene. I mean, there's multiple scenes, I guess, where they had the shelves and shelves of snakes and other reptiles, I'm assuming as well, in these, I mean, I don't know if we want to call them enclosures, essentially boxes, that seemed like they were just, you know, curled up in that box and that's where they are until someone opens it up and does something with them. And then I wonder if that series drew more negative attention to this non-traditional companion animal scene, or, I mean, it sent probably quite a few mixed messages. I'm not sure. The extreme side of it, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think it plays into a little bit, like Rebecca said, it's kind of what the animal likes. There's discussions in my species forum about what is the ideal enclosure for, say, a white-lipped python, and there's much disagreement on having a beautiful bioactive cage that's as close to their natural environment as possible, but your snake won't eat and is displaying a lot of stress signals. And then you've got the same exact snakes in these tubs with a heater and a cover, and they're honestly thriving. And it's the is it that we've just, it's not pretty, but that some people, and not that I think these massive collections necessarily are good, but it is interesting sometimes of, are we perceiving what we think the animal is going to thrive with, or is there a distilled down version where the animal is going to be more comfortable? But I am concerned with the massive collections and how much relationship can you have if you have 200 different breeding snakes? Is it the equivalent of a snake version of a puppy mill? Like, yeah, I get concerned at that point. But I have seen, when I grew up my snakes, you know, we joke it's the first reptile starter kit. Like, it's a box and a water dish and a really funny looking, you know, ground cover. And that snake would bust out of her cage and come find me. That was the coolest thing about her. She was a Florida king snake. And she would break out of her cage and find me in the house and just crawl right up on me and hang out. And you were just like, really? Yeah, I loved that snake. That snake was such an amazing, I mean, I had that snake for, I don't know, 15 plus years, and that snake was amazing. I love that animal.
I'm curious though, with the snakes that are comfortable, or maybe even, I don't know if we say that they're happy there, but who are more comfortable in those boxes than in the, like you're saying, the fancy enclosure. Do you think that they are happy because it's most similar to sort of what they're happy with if they weren't with humans? Or is it just that they were perhaps conditioned to it because that's all they know if they were at the breeder and they kind of grew up in that? Is that,
I mean? Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know because we can't just ask them. But right. I do know if they are in the wild, they're going to spend most of their time in a hole. Like, I'm speaking for royal or ball pythons specifically, because that's what I know about. But they will spend most of their time in a hole. They'll come out for food, they'll come out to mate, but most of their time is spent in seclusion. Yeah. So to have this big fancy enclosure isn't really necessary. And that's the argument I kept seeing, is if you want more than one, it's not worth setting up a full tank for each one. The breeder I know actually keeps them on a couple layers of paper towel in plastic pull-out trays, basically. But they do interact with each one. So they get to come out, they get to stretch out fully and move around a little bit and then go back in. So it's similar to a Pep's hide, where he can go in there. And I did disturb him today. I shouldn't, but I don't usually bother him when he's in his hide. If he's poking around, playing on the vines and stuff, I'll reach in and let him come to me. And he'll either come to me or he'll go like this, a little wiggle. And that tells me it's food time. like I said, he gets fed every 7 days, but sometimes it goes a little longer if he's not showing any signs that he's interested or if he hasn't past the last meal yet. And I think when you have that many, even little biological details like that, like is the snake ready for its next feeding, is something you'd have to open every single one every day to check. And it's hard to believe that that's, unless it's your full-time job, that that's something you can really keep up with. And that would be more my concern, is that even basic needs might not get met in situations like that.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I could see that happening if you have, I mean, that many of any animal, really.
Yeah.
Definitely. Bifrost is enjoying your hair, Molly.
Oh my God, he's in heaven right now. He is having so much fun. He's been up here for, you know, because we got situated, you know, before we started recording, and he's been at this for now like an hour plus, and he's just going to town doing my hair.
I actually remembered that in California, before I moved to Germany, where I'm living at the moment, I had a parrot for like not very long, like 6 months. But he was so funny because one day I think he just got out or something, and he flew across the street to the cafe that was there, and he'd fly there and he'd sit there and he would just people watch, and then he flew back. And so then it kind of became this ritual that we would let him out in the morning, and he would be able to fly across the street, because we were out in the country, it wasn't a lot of stuff happening. And he would just sit on his little perch. They made a little perch for him and he would stay there. And he would like maybe land on someone's head, or he would land on the perch, and he would just hang out there and watch people during the day. And then he would fly back in the evening. And I always thought that was a nice sort of middle road because, yeah, he was my parrot. Like, we're not going to lie about, of course, the way it works is you own this animal in a sense. You really do. As much as we would like to not think that way about them, but essentially we do. And what always bothered me about people with birds is the wing clipping. So on one hand, I do understand it, that it's like, okay, you don't want your bird to fly away. But on the other hand, it is sort of that line that I personally just, I'm not judging anyone who does, but just personally, I didn't want to cross that boundary. And it was just nice that he was able to go there and come back.
No, and it's cool you were able to create, you know, a biologically appropriate scenario. Bifrost is full flight, but I specifically trained him in the spaces so that he doesn't hit a window or he doesn't hit a ceiling fan or he can't harm himself while he's full flight. So I agree that there's some value and importance to allowing these biologically appropriate things, like being able to flap your wings and stretch your whole body and all of those important things, and then just trying to figure out the safest scenario. And clearly your bird wasn't taking off and just gone forever. Bird was just like, no, I'm just gonna people watch, I'm gonna peace out, and I'm gonna come home at night. And I think that's the best of all worlds.
And it's just that factor of boredom, I think, as well, because if I look at my dogs, I mean, sometimes the door is open, they can go outside, they can do their thing, but they're just sitting next to me, just like looking at me like, oh, this is the best thing I could be doing right now. I can't think of anything better. Even though they have the option to go outside and play and do stuff. And I sometimes wonder with other animals as well, it's that aspect of like, I don't know, but what would you be doing right now if you were in the jungle or if you were in the desert or if you were elsewhere?
Yeah.
Sort of keeping them not bored, happy.
Yeah, no, happy. 100%. I mean, that's one thing that people don't realize with birds is that they're highly, quote unquote, destructive. And I don't mean destructive in like they're doing it to be damaging, but they need to be able to take things apart and break them and break off pieces with their beaks and throw things. Like, this is how they feed forests. It's how forests grow, is that birds break things and drop them. And that's what they're good at. And so I have to be patient with that and go out and buy stuff knowing that, I mean, I know a lot of people who don't want to buy toys for their dogs because their dogs destroy them. And I'm like, but that's normal. They're gutting an animal, to be fair. These guys are going to destroy their toys, and larger parrots are going to require even bigger toys that cost a lot of money and can get destroyed in 15 minutes. And that angers and frustrates people that, oh, why can't my bird just have nice things? And but that's not how they work. They don't cherish their toys. They smash the hell out of them. And that means he's having fun. If I have him in there and I hear jingle, jingle, smash, 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 I know he's having a blast. And that's what he's supposed to do. I have this confetti like pinata thing in his tree, and it's just these pieces of paper, and he throws them at the dog, and it goes everywhere. And I clean all up, but he's having a blast.
Yeah. I think that's a really important point. I mean, even if we just bring it back to dogs for a second, it's where people love that aspect where they're with people, where they're, like you said, why can't we have nice things? They're behaving perfectly. They're that wonderful dog that just fits into society, and so to speak, whatever that means for that person and that dog. But they don't equally take on that dogness, or that, I don't want to say animalness, but that dogness of just being like getting dirty, running through puddles, rolling in it. And for your bird, as you said, being able to destroy things. And I'm not sure if snakes have something like that, but I guess it's that aspect of like, we want the animal to look nice, to do all these things, but not have those natural behaviors.
Yeah. I mean, I know screaming is a big reason why parrots are rehomed, but parrots naturally scream. He squawks and screams at certain times. I mean, we've tried to record many times, and all of a sudden he's screaming in the background because he wants to vocalize. And that's really inconvenient for people, especially owners of large parrots. Their birds are going to scream, and that's how they communicate. Cockatoos, absolutely. They're very social communal animals, and they do a lot of vocalizing, especially in the morning and in the evening. They have group calls. And if you don't want to listen to a parrot scream, you're not the right home for that relationship. And I think that's the tricky part, is again, why I don't like exotic, is exotic sort of points to having some sort of status with this unique thing. And it's like, really, I'm cohabitating with a feathered weirdo, because I'm a hominid weirdo, and this is a feathered weirdo, and we have a relationship. But I'm sorry, I cut you off for better. Go ahead.
Oh, no, that's fine. I was going to say the closest thing for me with regards to letting him be him is not handling him every day. because I want to. Like, I want to interact with him for my version of the relationship. I want to spend a ton of time with him. But he doesn't want that. Ow, ow. His tail is sharp at the very end, and he just grabbed on. Yeah, see?
I think that's a really interesting point, too, though. It's that we as people think, oh, because we're social animals, we think that, oh, they must want to socialize. We must be taking them out. I mean, that's my initial reaction is like, oh, that the more the snake is out and able to stretch out and like explore, the better, because, you know, I'm a social animal and also like a person who likes to interact with other people, right? So, but then that's not always best for the other animal then. So,
well, and that's very much taught when you first, like when you first look for snakes, or when you search snakes beginner or snakes for kids, or trying to learn like the very basics about snakes, it's a lot of handle them all the time when they're young, so they get used to you, but that's not what they want. So especially after eating, like he needs 48 hours minimum after eating to just be left alone to sleep and digest. Yeah, like it was an adjustment for me. I mean, I pick my cats up when they're not 100% wanting to be picked up because I want cuddles.
I want it, yeah.
Yeah. And so even drawing that barrier with them has been difficult. And so when it came to him and having discomfort with having a pet or owning a pet, I'll say that is just for looking at, adding the fact that I'm not supposed to touch him all the time kind of was a lot for me to process. And that's why he has his vines and he has his substrate that he can burrow in, so he can play by himself as much as he wants. But yeah, it is definitely about acknowledging their specific needs and the fact that they're not human and they don't want what humans want, which sounds basic and silly as I say it out loud, but like it's really easy to push our expectations onto our companion animals.
Yeah.
I mean, actually his door is open, so, and like I said, he's full flight, he can leave when he's ready, and he will sometimes. He'll just be like, and I'm done, peace out, and he flies off, and I just turn to make sure he made it and didn't just, he's not a very good flyer, make sure he's not toddling on the floor with the dog. But yeah, and sometimes it's really disappointing. Like, I'm hanging out with him, we're having a blast, and he pieces, and I'm like, oh, you left. But that's on me. That's my problem. That's not his. He's just done and wants to go eat, or knock on wood, wants to go to the bathroom or something like that. So, yeah, we have to sometimes be humble and be like, no, they absolutely have a right, even though he's only a few ounces and I can grab him and make him come back out.
Right. Yeah. I guess that happens a lot too anyway. Maybe if there's younger people in the household that are like, no, I really want to like play with the fill the blank.
Yeah.
I'm sure that happens constantly, that they're just getting kind of dragged into situations like that, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, ball pythons are actually a recommended beginner pet for kids because they don't need a lot of work and they're timid. Like they aren't aggressive when they're anxious. They're timid. So to think about that being enough knowledge for a chain pet store to put one of these in a kid's hands really does bother me.
That's actually a great point, though, is here we're pointing out that non-traditional animals are the preferred pet to point children towards. It's hamsters, it's snakes, bearded dragons are, you know, really popular with kids, because it's a pet that's both vegetarian and carnivorous and relative, it lives on sand. You know, it's we introduce, and I think I had some of that. We introduce kids to these animals, and they're not the dog and the cat. It's, you know, like Rebecca said, maybe it's a little easier in quotes, but the knowledge isn't there. And I mean, I see this on rescues all the time, you know, bearded dragon, free to good home, because kids aren't handling it enough. And my brain's like, that's interesting. Is it that they're not handling enough, or does it need to be handled that much? What is the perception of that owner that's giving up that animal?
And it's easier for whom? Like, it's easier for the human. It's always,
Yep.
He's holding the hand.
He's holding. You have a baby boat picture, don't you? You have a baby noodle picture?
I do have a baby noodle picture.
I want to see the baby noodle. That. When I saw you holding hands, I was like, I need to see the baby noodle.
Yeah, so that's the baby noodle.
Oh my God.
So he started off just fitting in the palm of my hand. And yeah, his head has barely grown since then at all. So now he's just a really thick noodle with the same size head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Has he finished growing?
He'll get a little bit thicker, but he's basically full length. The males, I wonder if he'll let me show you. Yeah, the males only get to about 3.5 feet and females get to about 4, but they get quite thick. Right. He's actually very strong. Like he keeps grabbing on and anchoring himself. Yeah, they're, it's interesting because there's a lot of areas in Ontario where I'm currently living, where anything that's in the python family is disallowed. So even this little guy that wouldn't be able to hurt a person, like maybe a very tiny person, but this little timid thing is put in the same category as pythons that could cause damage. And there's actually places where he would be taken from me because he'd be considered illegal. And that just points further to the lack of knowledge out there about non-traditional pets and about what's actually dangerous, or even just having a guarantee that people who own them know what they're doing with them.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you're right. People think those giant, you know, reticulated pythons, those enormous snakes that, yes, wreak havoc on ecosystems and are potentially dangerous to people and small pets. But yeah, you're APAP is not that snake, but you're right. It's what are the lawmakers thinking when they're sitting in a courtroom deciding what is dangerous? And they think the consequences of what these giant snakes could do outweighs what these small snakes, you know, what those relationships could look like. I think people, again, don't think, well, you could have a relationship with a snake or a bird or any of these things. Right? Oh my God, this nest you've made up here is quite impressive, my friend. It's like cotton candy up here right now. I know, you're mad. You're like, don't mess up my house.
Does he always do that when he's on your head?
He's mad now. Sometimes he'll stay up there. Sometimes he'll come down on my shoulder and like do little bits here and like climb in it and like nest in the looser stuff and like just hide underneath. One of his favorites is if I wear, like, I have a fuzzy hoodie that's fuzzy on the inside. If I put that over both of us, he just stays there and pops his head out. And he likes to climb in that. But he does like shoulders and head. And it's interesting. I mean, there's different takes on that. There are people that say it's a dominance behavior. Yes, dominance in avian relationships exists. But dominance in this scenario, I see him as nest. That's ethologically not the behavior I'm perceiving. He's not trying to show me his boss. He thinks my hair is awesome. And so I'm not worried that there's some sort of, people will say, oh, never let a parrot, you know, above your face, you know, this and that, it's status.
Really?
I'm like, no, okay. He doesn't care. Yes, there are large birds where you want to be careful because they could grab your nose or your ear and that's really going to hurt. No. I mean, he's cool up there and he's happy up there. He doesn't like to walk around on like flat surfaces very much. So he doesn't like my desk. I have to put a perch on the desk if I want him to stay on the desk. But usually that's why he prefers his tree, or he prefers his cage, or he prefers like my head and shoulder. He hasn't started climbing on the new shelves behind me yet, but I'm sure eventually he'll realize those are also awesome and have pencils he can throw.
Perfect. What more do you want in life than a shelf to climb and pencils to throw?
Yes. I think I would like to trade in my life. I would like to climb on things and throw pencils at this
point. Me too. Let's do that. Let's go.
To be honest, I wouldn't mind just hiding in a cave all alone right now.
Well,
especially 2020. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's a be a Paul Python kind of year.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's the new slogan for 2020.
So, you know, being somebody that is not a current co-relationship with a non-traditional animal person, I don't know. I didn't know how to articulate that. After talking about this, how do you reflect on this?
Well, I think it's, I'm reflecting on it similarly to how I reflect to humans who live with dogs, cats, horses, all of those more traditional companion animals, in the sense that it all comes down, I guess, to the relationship between the human and the, you know, whatever species it is. And that can be so different, right? Because like with dogs, it's like, of course, you want to make sure that they have the opportunity to go out, they can see different things, so all this different stuff. But with now with talking to Rebecca, it's like, oh, it can also be a good thing to quote unquote ignore your animal companion for two whole days. And that's what makes them happy. So I think that's been food for thought. And I guess the thing in my mind also is, one thing that crossed my mind while just listening to you guys was this thought of like, okay, but should we? Like we can, and we can make them happy, but should we? And then that whole discussion comes up of like, you know, I don't know, if they are happy with you and they do have a relationship with you. So that's where I'm at mentally right now, as I'm sort of trying to untangle that. I don't know what my opinion is on it yet, but I mean, I look at Apep and I look at Bifrost and I'm like, they look like they're happy, right? But
yeah,
I mean, would they be happier if they weren't here? But then I'm like, well, my dogs would probably be happier if they had, you know, been born out somewhere where they could roam all day and not be indoors, but they're happy now that they're here. I don't know.
Yeah, I go back and forth with this. I don't want to, quote unquote, enslave an animal that would be happier in another situation. I don't know. You know, you see, oh, these birds flying around the jungle and they look so happy. And then you'll have arguments about lifespan. Well, what's the lifespan like? What's the lifespan out here? Right. And I don't know. I don't think, especially certain sized animals, I think are more successful. I mean, look at him. He's the size of a coffee cup. Right. He's not, you know, he's not locked in a bathtub as it is, so to speak. And I mean, similar for Apep, he's not massive. He's not trapped in a very small scenario and they're very enriched lives. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think about this though with my New Guinea singing dog. You know, they live in Papua New Guinea running around, but then they can also live a very happy domestic life. And to be frank, he doesn't want to pee in the rain and he doesn't want to go outside when it's cold. So I think he specifically would be miserable in the upper glacial region of Papua New Guinea. But I don't know. I don't know. It's sort of like saying, would I be happier if I'd grown up in a city, or would I be happier if, you know, because I grew up semi-rural? It's just so hard. And I think, but it's such a great exercise to chew on it, to not just be like, no, better off with me, but to be like,
yeah,
you know, that whole thing.
Yeah.
I think that extends to indoor outdoor cat debate as well. Like, I think even with the traditional companion animals, it's still, should we even live with them? Are we doing them a disservice by doing that? And hi, are you getting fussy?
I love his little home soon. The front part of his little snout is just the best.
Yeah, he's got the little breathing holes, but because they're dark, it almost looks like he's smiling all the time.
Mm-hmm. He's cute. He does.
He's gonna come right to the camera now. Okay.
He's the star of this. He's so handsome.
Yeah, for anyone who's just listening to the audio, this probably sounds silly, but yeah, Apep's trying to get famous. but yeah, I think that's, and I don't think we can answer that question here. I think that's something that's just, it's just important that we keep thinking about it and keep talking about it.
Yeah,
I guess it's one of those many unanswerable questions when we look at it through the anthropology lens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And on that note, thank you for joining us. This has been The Shifting Lens, and with myself, Rebecca, Molly, and Tiamat, and we hope you tune in for the next one. Yay. Bye.
Bye. Bye.